From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, oh yes, those open lines. Well, U.S. stocks fell sharply Friday after a stronger-than-expected jobs report sent interest rates higher. Stock market didn't like that. Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 665 points to close at 25,520. It actually, if you averaged it, dropped 666. The U.S. economy in January continued the slow but steady improvements that have been characterized by the post-recession period, as federal economists reported that employers added 200,000 jobs last month, while employment held steady at 4.1%. Registered investment advisor Mitch Sedlock with us. Mitch, what do you think? It's holding strong, isn't it?
The jobs report was a good one today, George. I dove into that, and I look at all the details. You know I go through it. And the one weakness I thought that was weird is they were trumping up the wage growth, but it appeared in one report or one stat. It didn't appear in the other one. I think the one where it didn't appear is the correct one, but I did expect it to jump because we saw the minimum wage go up in 18 states. So I was actually surprised by what I saw, but then other people saw what I didn't. So I don't know. But yeah, the stock market's a little bit spooked here. There's talk now of more than three hikes this year. And we had San Francisco Fed President John Williams come out today, and he was trying to calm the markets down. He was saying, well, you know, don't worry, we're going to do it gradual. But meanwhile, and he also said, and this I thought was kind of funny, he said, we see no signs of a bubble. Now, Alan Greenspan was on just 3 days ago, and he said there's an obvious bubble. Now, the curious thing about this, George, is this comes from a man, when he was the Fed chairman, he said there's no way to spot a bubble until after it bursts. So, you know, all of this stuff is kind of crazy, but I'm going to repeat what I said. I was on, I think it was on Tuesday, and I think the stock market is in a bubble. I think we're going to see declines of at least 30%, probably 50%, and perhaps more. So when we're looking at this decline today, not even a down payment for what I think is going to happen, George.
Have a good weekend, Mitch. As the Trump administration plans new U.S. nuclear firepower, leaked Pentagon documents reveal that Russia is building and developing a nuclear torpedo that would leave a country's coastline uninhabitable for years. It's been called a doomsday torpedo. I'm sure we have the same thing. A House memo stating disputed dossier was the key to the FBI's warrant to surveil members of the Trump team. It was a major story, a much-hyped memo that shows alleged government surveillance abuse during the 2016 campaign has been released to the public and cites testimony from a high-ranking government official who says that the FBI and the Department of Justice would not have sought surveillance warrants to spy on a member of the Trump team without the infamous Democrat-funded anti-Trump dossier. Howard Bloom, he's a liberal, but let's get his take on this one. Go ahead, Howard.
Okay, here's the deal. The Nunes memo has sucked up all the oxygen in the room for a full week, and it's a distraction. The real question is this. Did the Russians manipulate the presidential election of 2016? And if they did, how do we stop this meddling in 2018 and beyond? Yes, there are a few lesser questions. Are the FBI and the Justice Department run by diehard Democratic zealots who will make up lies to hang Donald Trump? Or are the Democrats in these agencies onto something real? And is the Steele memo true? Is Donald Trump, that is it true, not who financed it, is Donald Trump an unwitting dupe of the Russians? Has Trump successfully been turned into a Russian asset? Those are some of the implications of the Steele memo. But these questions are trivial by comparison. The Russians are the enemies of democracy. They have been manipulating elections in France, the Ukraine, Bulgaria, Estonia, and Austria. But Democrats and Republicans are not enemies of democracy. In fact, we are all in this together. Now, look, our real problem is that we are operating or we are opening ourselves to the Russians and the Chinese by tearing each other to pieces. Some Republicans are convinced that Bill and Hillary Clinton ran the biggest criminal enterprise in presidential history from the White House. Many Republicans are certain that Hillary presided over a child pornography ring based out of the Comet Ping Pong Pizza Parlor in Washington, D.C. Some Republicans are certain that the Clintons murdered anyone they thought would rat on their operation. And some Republicans are certain that Barack Obama is a Muslim and a Marxist. In fact, some Republicans think Obama is so anti-American that he should be arrested for his treason. On the other side, Democrats like me believe that Donald Trump wants to be the first American tin pot dictator. Some of us Democrats believe that Donald Trump is trying to purge everyone from the FBI and the Justice Department who is not a kamikaze Donald Trump loyalist. Some of us Democrats even believe that Trump wants to turn the FBI and the Justice Department into personal stormtroopers and that he wants them to back up his beliefs no matter how wild and crazy those beliefs prove to be. And those beliefs of Trump's are often way off base. He doesn't know how to fact check. In a tweet the day after Tuesday's terrific, really good State of the Union speech, Donald Trump claimed that he had the biggest audience in history, but that's not true. George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Bill Clinton all had bigger audiences. If Trump insists that his Justice Department and his FBI prove his false beliefs to be truths, we will all be in trouble. Now, look, we Democrats and Republicans have to pull together and realize that we all believe in the Constitution, democracy, and liberty. The Byzantines in 640 A.D. had two factions that tore each other to pieces. They were called the Greens and the Blues, and they went at each other's throats. Because the Byzantines were so busy attacking each other, they lost their empire to a newcomer on the scene, the armies of Islam. Eventually, the Byzantines lost their entire empire. We do not want that to happen to us. Pay attention to what counts. Pay attention to the Russians and to the Chinese.
How would you like a showdown with the conservative John Curtis? Two go in, one comes out. You willing?
I'd love it.
All right, we'll set it up. The number of men dying from prostate cancer has overtaken female deaths from breast cancer for the first time in the United Kingdom. An aging population means that more men are developing and dying from that disease. Dennis Edwards, the lead singer of The Temptations, has died at the age of 74. Edwards joined the band in 1968 and sang with them on and off until 1989, was the lead singer on hits including Papa Was a Rolling Stone, I Can't Get Next to You, and Cloud Nine. No word on why he died or how. Archaeologists have harnessed sophisticated technology to reveal lost cities and thousands of ancient structures deep in the Guatemalan jungle, confirming that the Maya civilization was much larger than previously thought. It's an amazing story. Well, a story that we talked about a couple days ago, D.B. Cooper claims that he might have been a CIA agent. In a moment, I'll talk with a documentary filmmaker, Thomas Colbert, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, the leader of the private investigative team who has spent years trying to crack the D.B. Cooper hijacking case claimed that he believes the mysterious criminal was a CIA agent whose identity has been covered up by the federal agents. Thomas Colbert, a documentary filmmaker who helped put together the 40-member team, says his team made the connection from work a codebreaker uncovered in each of the last five letters apparently sent by Cooper. Now, Thomas is a former senior media executive with 36 years of management and editorial experience in the national news scene, television, entertainment, publishing, and motion picture fields. He began his career in journalism and research at the CBS flagship news station KCBS back in 1980, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Thomas, what a story, isn't it?
How are you, George? We've been listening to you for a long time. We're down here between the mud and fire zones of California.
Oh, my gosh. How did you get interested in the D.B. Cooper case?
Well, let's just say, as a senior researcher at KCBS in Los Angeles for almost 10 years, I would roll my eyes every few months when somebody came in and said it was their husband and or an uncle or it was them themselves or carrying in files. And so I got it over the years. But one thing, I was a instructor for 10 years at Camp San Luis for crisis management.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I met a lot of my cold case members. And one thing at the water cooler they always talked about is nobody believed that money found in 1980 on the river just happened to float there 7 years later or 8 years later with some crumbling rubber bands still on it. And I get a call and that was in 2011 from a cameraman I trust in Vegas, and he tells me there's a man here I've just been tipped to in my casino grapevine who has something on his chest. I sat him down, and he claims to have witnessed the planning of the money planting.
Wow.
And that got my notebook out. Because that is where we, for 8 months, listened to a story about this former drug runner, Ron Carlson, telling us about his drug dealer. And drug dealer claimed for over a year to be D.B. Cooper. And he bragged about it, and nobody believed it. He was too short. He wasn't the right look. But then one day at a cocaine party with new clients, he brought in that drug runner and his partner, and he said, "I know you still don't believe me, but I'm going to prove it to you. See that couple over there? They and their son," and then he pointed out the window at the Columbia River, "on that north side right over there, in 4 days, they're going to find some of my money." Well, they, yeah, sure, boss. They left. Huh. They headed out on a drug run, and then they turn on the tube in Reno on their run. And there is that couple and the boy right on the shore bragging how they dug that up.
And found some of that cash.
Exactly.
What a story. Now, was this so-called D.B. Cooper still alive?
That particular D.B. Cooper. We spent 8 months working on this man and realizing it wasn't right. But then we heard he had a crime partner. And it was from Pudgy Hunt, a wonderful basketball player and the Northwest bar owner, one of the frat brothers of this drug dealer, and he was my last phone call, and he said, "No, he couldn't have been Cooper. He was in my bar when that happened." And then he said, "But you know, I introduced him to a Vietnam guy. In fact, he was an award. Matter of fact, he was a Cooper suspect for a while on a job we were doing, putting the floor in at Pepperdine University." And that's when I said, "Thank you, Jesus, you found me a crime partner." And
it
that's
was
when we knew.
It was easy in 1971 to hijack a plane, much more than it is today, isn't it?
You could be smoking a cigarette getting on the plane. You can have your scotch without IDs. You'd you'd pick up on the stewardesses, as they like still today to be called from that generation. It was the Frank Sinatra's "Flying to the Moon" was absolutely how people lived.
Why do we still have this love affair with the D.B. Cooper case, Tom?
Last unsolved hijacking, one of the last outlaws of the Old West before technology and crime fighting really developed. All they had was fingerprints and hunches, sort of like arson squads and fire department. There was no forensics, no videotape in the stores, nothing. So it is the last romantic period, and what we did is combined some of those gumshoe investigators, the ones that used to knock on doors and turn over rocks, and matched it with high tech, and that's how we got him.
We talked with attorney Mark Zake tonight, who couldn't come on, who found some of these FBI documents. Tell us about the documents and how they point toward this person.
Well, you have to understand our team. We got permission from the FBI headquarters with a letter to work and collaborate with the FBI and deliver evidence. We spent 3 years undercover with the cold case team of 40 members, 13 of them FBI, and they dug up 102 pieces of evidence, including DNA. And we brought it the week we were to turn it in. They slammed the door on us. Suddenly said, "Well, we don't want a circumstantial case, but if you find that parachute money, we'll let you know." Well, that's when my wife and I and the team, who was livid, we sued, as we do in California.
Mm-hmm.
And we sued the FBI, and it took a half year, and we won. And ever since January of last year, we've been getting 500, 600 pages, thanks to Mark Zade, into our website, dbcooper.com, and people can read some of the information up there. And that's how it started. We started getting the secrets from those files.
What was DB's motive, the $200,000?
No, actually, he was a award-winning pilot, acclaimed pilot, nice guy, but he was also a con artist. And he was also, we can say, according to his family and his first wife, a wife beater. And he unfortunately was found choking his wife.
Jeez.
At
nice guy.
Fort Rucker. And they, at that time, sadly, wouldn't arrest an enlisted man, especially an officer, for those type of things. They looked the other way. So they looked into his background to see what they could get him on. And lo and behold, he faked attending two colleges. And he faked being a captain when he was a first lieutenant. And so they said, in essence, Well, you can be court-martialed or you can resign. He resigned, and it's all of our opinions that he resigned to stick it to the man.
And he did.
He certainly did.
At this point, why didn't they try to go after the guy?
They did. But back then, again, because of the lack of forensics and other things, they interviewed lots of people, and there are a lot of different researchers and Cooperites, as they're lovingly called by many, who have their own suspects and so forth. Our guy wasn't found until 1978. He got away. And that's the reason they couldn't find him, but he got in trouble for other crimes, and that's when local cops noticed his skill sets, his looks, his talents, his aviation and paratrooping skill, and they tipped the FBI in 78. The FBI went after him, chased him all over the world. This guy didn't escape once. He escaped three times by plane and once by river. We've counted so far and confirmed 22 fake identities and six careers and three families in five countries.
My gosh. Now, did he
off the scale?
Did he bring the parachute with him aboard the plane?
That was part of the bargaining. He said he opened up his briefcase and showed the stewardess several of them and said, I'm going to blow up the plane unless we get $200,000 and four parachutes. Brilliant to say four, because if he said two, you might imagine they would have fixed those parachutes so they wouldn't open. They were fearful that he was going to take a hostage, so they didn't mess with him.
Smart.
Very smart man. And not one print found in the back of the plane. And that's key to our case. There is fascinating research up on your website tonight we've put up, not only on the cover-up, not only the accusations of out-and-out lies that the FBI trying to avoid putting this man on trial, but they're going to see some incredible evidence.
Was the fact that he was a CIA agent the reason why they wanted this quiet?
I'm going to correct you on one fact. He was never an agent. He was a what they called a contractor, a in-pocket relationship. He is no candidate for an agent.
Okay.
He's one of the wild men they use to fly planes to work on the grounds. And the CIA met him literally in a bar on his base with First Cab in Vietnam. We know this because his former commander watched them, and he stole another commander's Jeep, mounted a 50 cal, filled it with explosives, and went out with the CIA numerous times for days at a time off the books. That's when it began. And we have since learned, and we'll talk about the codes a little later, that his arrangements with the CIA went on for decades, all the way into the 80s.
After Vietnam.
After Vietnam. He was out of Vietnam in 71. He did the jump. He was caught in 78. When he got in trouble in February 79 is when we noticed, suddenly, after chasing him all over the world, suddenly the FBI said, well, we don't think he's a serious suspect. That's when we think the CIA stepped in and said, we want this boy. We've been following him for a long time.
Kind of paint us a picture, if you would, Thomas, on when he boarded the Northwest Orient flight in 71, what it was like, where did he board it, and what was the plan?
Well, he was very smart. Again, there was a hijacking. There was between, 68 and 72, there was close to 200. I don't have the exact figure in my head. Close to 200 hijackings in the United States. And there was 1-2 weeks before where a man, while he's putting on a parachute, put his gun down. And he learned. And so what he did is he sat in the back row so nobody would be behind him, and he could monitor everybody. So he was one of the last people to get on the first people to get on the plane, took that seat, and watched everybody come in. It was about, I'm guessing now, about a third to half full. And there were a few people near him, but not a lot. And he had it all set. He had the briefcase on his lap. He handed a note to one of the stewardesses. She thought it was a pickup note. She put it in her pocket. And then he informed her, no, you need to read that. And that's when it all began.
And when this happened, did they land to get the money and then they took off again?
Wasn't that simple. They had to get the money. Now, banks back then, because of all the hijackings and other things going on, were having ransom money ready. If not all, most of it was ready. It was set aside by the bank. The parachutes were gathered from parachuting companies and parachuting rental spots. And those, so they circled for, I believe, a few hours. And eventually they landed when they had the money ready. The bag was brought on board. The parachutes were brought on board. The passengers, who were never told, they were just said there was engine trouble. They were escorted off, and then he said, take me to Mexico.
Stay with us, Tom. We're going to come back and talk more about that. Then we'll get into the codes. What a fascinating story. Phone calls with Thomas Colbert next hour. And welcome back. Thomas Colbert with us. Thomas, how did D.B. Cooper jump out of a Boeing 727 without getting killed?
That's a great question. It's pretty simple. This man was trained to jump into trees and rocks with the Green Berets off the books. He was a halo jumper, high altitude, low open. And that's how they could drop him midday from airliners way up. So you would think, oh, it's a passing airliner, when they didn't open it until they were right above the jungles. They were trained to jump out the back door of that particular aircraft. The aircraft were in Thailand and used for special missions.
Tell us about the codes.
The codes came to us because of our FOIA. We had secrets popping in left and right. We got the escape story where they interviewed seven farmers talking about watching this aircraft in a car with headlights, practicing on the fields the day before, the day of. That matches oral stories we've heard from people and witnesses. Then we get a fifth letter. Four letters were cut and pasted, ha-ha, you can't find me letters to the authorities, much like the Zodiac Killer had done. And they were photographed, and two of them were put in newspapers. The rest were grabbed up by the FBI right after they were mentioned. But there was a fifth letter that was grabbed, a typed one. And what made this different is that the authorities literally felt it was real. It's the first time, George, I read anywhere in all the documents, they actually used the word excited in the FBI, saying that this letter is, let's compare it to disgruntled pilots, let's try to find it. The most important part in the letter that made this happen was a statement by the alleged hijacker at the time, now we know it is, where he said, and I left no prints in back of the plane. That was a secret, as I said earlier, till the mid-80s. The fact that was in there, no one knew it except Cooper. But what happened one day is, after we broke this letter in November, one of our 40 members happened to be a Vietnam codebuster.
Uh-huh.
He was in the same unit as Mr. Rackstraw, Robert Rackstraw. And he looked at that letter when I sent it to the cold case team, and he said, give me 2 weeks. And this poor guy, more correctly, his poor wife, this guy has 11 codes in his head for 50 years. Probably points at the TV and says, there's code there.
That's right.
He called me, and he said, give me 2 weeks. And he went through this letter, and he called me back, and he said, Tom, you're not going to believe this. There are three military units buried at the bottom of it. Your listeners can go to the website and see the letter, and among those three were two top secret, kept secret until the late 80s. I called his commander, tracked down his commander, now Lieutenant Colonel retired, Ken Overturf, and Ken said, I've been through the records, and I can tell you this is the only soldier in the whole U.S. Army during Vietnam that had these three units. Well, Rick Sherwood is the codebreaker. He didn't quit. You know, we sort of talked about the other letters, but I didn't really give him direction. And on his own, 2 weeks later, I get a call, and he says, Tom, there are codes in all these damn letters. And that's where we got the codes that are posted up on your website.
That's pretty dramatic. Is anybody else investigating the D.B. Cooper case?
There are several people, as I said, that have several suspects over the years. And God bless them, because they did some... These four original letters were found by a attorney up in Alaska that did the legwork and found them. And if we hadn't found those letters, for example, the first and last of those four letters, we noticed, my team at home here, my wife and my daughter Jazzy up at UCSB, we looked at that letter and information, and we noticed the mailing codes. They were dropped in post boxes less than 30 minutes from his house in the High Sierra in the first year and a half after the jump. And one of my cold case guys, an FBI guy, said, Tom, this is an 8 out of 10. Again, FBI had no reaction.
Well, the jump was 47 years ago. How old do you think D.B. Cooper was at that time?
We know exactly how old he was because we know we have him now, and that's Robert Rackstraw was 28. One of the things he mentioned, besides no fingerprints, he said he wore a toupee and he wore makeup, putty makeup. And that explains how a 28-year-old could look 40 to 30.
Yeah, he does look 40s in his in these sketches.
Yes, and that sketch was provided by a student next to him, right across the way, wondering why all the cute girls were sitting next to him, the stewardesses. And he's, what's this guy got? He's balding, and he's older, and look at him. What about me? I'm a strapping student. Well, that student is the one that created that second sketch, not the Bing Crosby one everybody knows, but the second one. And that second one, according to active law enforcement, not on my team, looked at it and said, Tom, there are 9 points of match in this sketch to your guy.
So he's 75 years old now.
74.
74, 75, okay. And could he be charged? Is there a statute of limitation here?
Well, statute of limitation was applied on the last day and the last evening by a federal grand jury in Oregon, and a U.S. attorney got together with the agent in charge, and they applied it. And that means that John Doe, if he's identified as Cooper someday, the statute of limitation will kick back in, and that five-year period will move ahead. Well, about half those cases have been thrown out by the Supreme Court, and half have not. I truly felt... And my experts in law, and we have three of them on the team, felt that this man would probably get a few years, maybe an electronic ankle bracelet for a few years on his leg, and then 20 years of probation, and then he'd never have to buy a beer again.
Yeah, he never hurt anybody, right?
Well, I would argue to you, all three stewardesses we have found out have major trauma, just like
trauma. I mean, but he physically didn't beat anybody up or anything like
that. He didn't physically beat them up, yes, but no, he did not. But I would argue to you, right and wrong is the key here. And we are not picking on our warriors that work in the dark and in CIA around the world to protect us. What we care about is when one comes home and laughs at our laws. And that's why this team is hunting him and did find him.
How much money did he drop in the woods?
We have the story of the escape, and we have the story of the burial from one of his three crime partners that helped him get away with three small planes and three strips, farmer strips. And they also mentioned the mountain where it was buried. And it was told to our source in 97, and they said it's down a particular canyon. There is one curve, a particular curve. There's a logger's road there, a trail. Go down 300 yards, and there's a tree. And that's where we dug, and we found five materials that we presented to the FBI lab. We actually found two of his three crime partners still alive, and they're out there. We gave those addresses to the FBI, and we gave the dig spot for them to do CSI. And after 5 months, they've done nothing.
Why?
Now, as I told you, we have a man that we've determined, and we have you on your website. We'll see there are 17 examples of cover-up, of stonewalling, of disinformation, and flat-out lies, all because this man has a history of providing to this country under black ops for the CIA.
Where's he living now?
He is in San Diego, and you can find him in a million-dollar condo on Bankers Hill. He's got a little boat shop, and he has a 45-foot yacht in the harbor. You're going to love it. It's called Poverty Sucks. I'm not making this up.
That's funny. What do you think he did with his $200,000, less what he dropped off in the woods?
Well, we know what happened with about $150,000 of it. It was put in the woods with the parachute, and this is what the storyteller says. What's interesting is he also said $50,000 of it and the briefcase bomb were put in the first plane, and before they switched planes at another runway, they flew over Vancouver Lake. Vancouver Lake used to be a curve on the Columbia River until 1,000 years it broke off. Well, it's a very shallow lake full of mud. They dropped that money, according to the source, and the briefcase bomb, with the hope it would be found and they would think he had drowned. Well, it went straight into the mud. It was not found until 1980, when those three bundles of money were buried inches down with their rubber bands crumbling in the general area. And that was smart because we believe Cooper, Rackstraw, didn't want to plant it in a far-off place because if any of that money peered up, somebody would say something's wrong here. Something was planted. He planted it right between, less than a mile from Vancouver Lake, right on the shore of Tenabar. Well, the national news covered the first day and saw the money found on the surface, but the local news covered over the days, and lo and behold, the agent in charge on the shore, who's now a friend of this investigation and feels Rackstraw did this whole thing, the agent said, keep digging, who knows, maybe we'll find his bones and his briefcase bomb. Well, 2 to 3 feet down, up and down the beach, they find shards, pieces of the Cooper money, thousands of pieces buried 2 to 3 feet down. They could not explain it on camera, and there is footage of that. But the problem is that never went national. Only the local news knew that, and some smart folks up on the dbcooperforum.com are the ones that really put this together, and we owe it to them for this tip, because that money was found, and we believe it was the money dropped in neighboring Vancouver Lake, and a floodplain moved it across. There was a 1976 digging of that lake, where dredging, where they put it on the shore, right where the floodplain took it, we believe, and it buried itself in 76 until it was dug up in 1980 by accident when they found the stuff on top. It's an amazing twist, but it explains that our story is absolutely true. Compared to the FBI notes and the interviews with the farmers, an LA Times reporter who went all the way up there 3 days after the FBI. And to give you an example of our frustration, George, we have all this stuff now in the FOIA. We're looking at the farmer interviews. We're looking at the money being found and so forth. But it's all being redacted. Now, why, if you've closed a case and it's in an archive, would you redact the word D.B. Cooper in front of the word letter on that fifth letter? They took it out 7 times when they sent it to us, including 6 of them from J. Edgar Hoover's own memo. Why would they cover up the fields?
Exactly.
They deleted the fields. They deleted the streets. They deleted the strips.
Did you ever have a chance to talk to Rackstraw?
We sat down with Rackstraw. We tried to convince him that if he turned himself in afterwards, we'd do a movie and book, and you know, eventually that would come out.
Did you see anything in his face that might have given you the idea that it was him?
That it was Cooper?
Yeah.
Well, when I asked, we had talked to close to 40 of his friends, crime partners, 2 ex-wives, and a flyaway girlfriend, and we knew it was him. And we said that. And I
did they?
Did who?
The friends.
Oh, yeah. A lot of them did.
Yeah.
And they all felt it was true. Now, most of them didn't know him in 71, but his sister did. And on her deathbed, she told us she believed he was Cooper.
What a great story. Now, do you think he's dangerous if you approached him?
Well, we did approach him. And we approached him with 3 surveillance men, FBI, former FBI with guns, just to be careful. Because we know
he's
involved in other serious crimes.
But he pulled nothing on you or anything
like
that?
No, he was 69 when that happened. He's now 74. He has a pacemaker. He had a stroke about 5 months after we met with him. It had nothing to do with us. I think it's had to do with the lie he's been carrying all these years.
Might he leave the story behind one day?
I don't think he can. He's a sociopathic narcissist, according to friends and judges who've had him in court. He lives for the day, but he can't. And one of my FBI guys said he's probably killed people, and that's one of the few things he could be cited for now.
Oh, really?
Hmm. Oh, yeah. He was arrested for murdering his own stepdad, the man that hid him for 1.5 years after the jump, but he was found not guilty by a jury. And that's an amazing twist in the book that we have out, The Last Master Outlaw. Your folks must look at the book because it covers all of this.
Is the guy insane, Thomas?
I wouldn't call him insane. I would say he is a narcissistic sociopath. They are brilliant. And this man, as I told you, leading 22 different personalities, 3 families. I mean, it's an incredible story.
And with that kind of cash, what do you think he netted?
Well, in today's dollars, it'd be over $1 million, but we truly feel that he knew all the numbers were out, all the codes were out, and he'd be tracked, and we truly feel he buried it, most of it, kept a little of it to plan on the coast, and I don't think he really spent most of it. I think it was buried. What he did spend, I mean, he was known to carry cougar ants. Two of his former girlfriends and a crime partner said he would carry cougar ants around. That drug runner who planted the said he was Cooper and planted the money for him was a 7-year crime partner, cocaine partner, who exchanged cougar ants. And in 1974, we have a witness that saw them together. And under the feet of Mr. Rackstraw was a gunny sack of money. We believe there was some of the money exchanged for cougar ants.
Now, was some of this money marked?
All of it was marked.
It was marked.
And marked in the sense that they had all the serial numbers, or 99% of them. And so that those memos were sent around all over the United States and Canada. The cocaine dealers' partners were down in South America. And again, it's a theory. We think that some went down there. He gave him a certain amount. He got a little less back, bought properties, and that's where it went.
Do you think that... He might have had some of the money tainted, you know, with the, you know how it blows up sometimes when you take it from a bank?
They weren't doing that back then. In 71, that wasn't routine. And I don't know. I have not seen anything in the thousands of pages we've looked at already that talked about that type of item being used or should it be used, because we have memos of them planning to deal with it.
Did he bring the plane down low enough so it decompressed?
He actually, there was no issue at that, because they were flying I'm not clear on the total facts, but I believe about 10,000 feet. And that way, when the door opened, there would not be a pressure problem.
They go out the back door?
Back.
And off he went?
Yep.
Man, he must have flew out of there like a bullet.
No, again, there was no pressure issue, and he sat on the stairs for... He was alone in the back for a half hour.
Was it a nighttime jump?
Oh, yes. And the Tina, the stewardess, was sent up in the cabin. They closed the curtain. He wiped it down for a half hour. Then he sat on the stairs for about 5 minutes. Again, we have a plane circling and partner and partners on the ground, and he knew exactly where to jump, and that's how they hooked
up. Remarkable. Phone calls next with you, Thomas, on Coast to Coast AM.